Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners. If you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with Rose Marshak and Rick Valentin of The Poster Children. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll dig into Rose's new memoir, Play Like a Man. But first, some new music from Iris DeMent and Screaming Females. That is Working on a World, the title track from the new Iris DeMent album. Iris DeMent, she might as well be the face of Americana music in America. She's been making records for 30 years. Born in Arkansas, the last of 14 kids, Jim.
Yeah.
Late bloomer. Didn't put out her first album until she was 32 in 1992. And what an album that was. Infamous Angel was very well received. She was signed to Warner Brothers. Big label putting out this, country singer by the guy who signed Joni Mitchell and James Taylor, among other people. So they figured they thought we have a hugely distinctive voice, throwback to the Carter family, early gospel music. Musically, she didn't fit in any category at that time. There was a mix of country, folk, gospel, pop, bluegrass. Sort of a tweener, you know?
Yeah.
Where does she fit? Emmylou Harris, Roseanne Cash, Lucinda Williams, Sean Colvin. There were a bunch of women artists in that era who were making similar kinds of music. Iris was a little bit younger than them, but at the same time, 32 years old, and had this experience in her voice that was undeniable. Takes her time making albums, 6 albums between 1992 and 2015. Working on a World is her 7th album and first in 8 years. Let's hear what Iris has got in store for us. Here's the song The Sacred Now from Working on a World on Sound Opinions.
A dream come true from way back when. We remember then forget again. Just for
that is The Sacred Now from Iris DeMent's new album, Working on a World. Oh, Craig, I kind of feel like I'm going to go kick a lovable puppy.
Jeez.
You know, I first started fighting on the radio about Iris DeMent when I reviewed that first album 30 years ago, my God, with Bill Wyman in an earlier, and I will say inferior version of Sound Opinions. And he was just a gas. I had him so mad he was sputtering, literally. Iris has it causes me two problems. Number one, that self-conscious, old-timey, you said Carter Family and early gospel. I love both of those sounds. You know, to me, Iris has always been like of the Lenny Kravitz, I'm dabbling in this sound kind of thing. And it's been a bit put on. Says some yodeling, some
You think that's a put on sound?
It just rubs me the wrong way. Maybe you know, I'm a city boy, man. If I don't have concrete underfoot, I get antsy. And something about the backwoods church porch kind of thing bothers me. I've learned to get over that. I don't hate it in other artists. But, man, here's the biggest problem with working on a world. Iris is a well-meaning person. She has empathy for many people. But the self-conscious shout-outs. Now, I'm a huge Mahalia Jackson fan. I teach Mahalia in a class at Columbia, and the tribute to Mahalia is okay.
Mahalia, Mahalia. I'm reaching back now to you.
That's on the good side of Iris and her empathetic political view. The bad side is going down to sing in Texas, where she sings about, you know, everybody's going to carry a gun, and that everybody will be so much safer is the biggest lie under the sun. That's not even the worst lyric. The worst lyric in that song, I know a couple of Muslims, and they seem pretty decent folks to me. I'd take any one of them over that evangelist I'm watching on TV. Oh, man.
I know a couple of Muslims, and they seem like pretty decent folks to me. I'd take any one of them over that evangelist I'm watching on TV.
Greg, John Lewis... The Squad, she's shouting out the chicks for the trouble they got in when they criticized George Bush. I mean, that like ancient history. We're huge fans of the chicks, okay? And we talked about that then. Iris, man, she's talking about Palestine. She's talking about gun laws. She's, and it's preachy in a Bono way. It is not humorous. It is not insightful. It's really heavy-handed, and it just kills this album for me.
Yeah, I don't think it's heavy-handed at all. I do, and I strongly disagree with your assessment that this is some kind of a put-on. You know, she grew up, she was born in Arkansas to a very poor family. Both the mom and the dad, the mom sang, the dad played violin. They sang four-part gospel harmonies around the piano. She had no experience with popular music until she saw an Emmylou Harris concert when she was a teenager. And the light bulb sort of went on, like, oh, wow, you can do this in front of an audience instead of in a church. But she's coming from a hardcore church background, and she has had spoken openly about her problems with, you know, faith and the whole idea of, you know, having a church, an institution like that, dictate the way you should feel about other people and God and things like that.
Yeah, but
she's wrestling with some of those issues all the way through.
The song "Let Me Be Your Jesus," you know, the messianic aspiration.
Do you know what that song's about, though?
Yeah, I know.
That is her. You know, we're talking about a cult figure, a demagogue.
Yes.
Who is trying to seduce you?
I'll lead you to the promised land where everyone is white.
And I think her voice in that song, I think one of the great things about this album is the way her voice has grown over the years. She's sort of gone from that sort of Maybelle Carter thing that she had early on, the early gospel stuff, that was a huge influence on her life. That's the kind of music she sang and grew up with
Mahalia
for 15
Jackson.
Years. That's the only music she knew.
Amen, hallelujah, Mahalia Jackson. So, I admire her as much as Iris DeMent, but, you know, when she's talking about how cool it was that Jesus kicked the money changers out of the temple, it's like, man, I'll go back and listen to Jesus Christ Superstar.
So what's this record really about? You're saying it's about preaching and about, you know, Jesus or whatever. I think you're on the wrong trail there, because I think the record spells out what it's about right away. Working on a World, that track. What is it? What is she saying in that? Working on a World I May Never See. It's a mindset where she's working through stuff that in this world right now we're not really happy about, and it can get a person incredibly depressed. She admits, like, you know, circa 2016,
yeah,
beyond that, she was, you know, she was in dumps, you know, as were many people about what's happening to our country. You know, the whole idea, like, we're searching for that more perfect union. The idea that we do not have a more perfect union is very real. And she's saying that's, we're not there yet, but we're here to keep working for it. And I think that's what this album is about. It's about finding meaning and purpose in a world where it feels meaningless and purposeless a lot of the times.
No,
and
I know.
I think that's the central message that she's trying to communicate in this music, and I think she does it very powerfully.
You just left off the second half of that couplet, though. She's working on a world I may never see, joining forces with the warriors who came before me.
Right.
I just don't need the entire phone book of all the warriors.
Well, she's basically talking about people that have been part of her life, the Mahalia Jackson references,
John Lewis,
Chekhov, John Lewis, you know, the Bible. I mean, those are those are things that have influenced her.
A lot of MLK
she's
references.
She's checking on that. And she's saying all of those things were written or they created and were written under times of stress and turmoil. She's saying, you know, we ought to continue building on that.
The only time I really feel like she gave me insight was when she's singing about Mahalia Jackson. I mean, that was an extraordinary woman, one of the greatest artists of all time, and her story is so inspiring. I wouldn't mind John Lewis and MLK references, or even The Squad, if we got a little more insight from Iris. That is a little bit of a track called Brass Bell, the opening song on the new album, The Eighth, by the Screaming Females, or the Screamales, Greg, as fans call them. This band has been around a very long time now. Same trio that came together in the bars and punk dives of New Brunswick, New Jersey, way back circa 2006-2007. And it's the first album since 2018. Pandemic waylaid them. Marissa Paternoster, the guitarist, vocalist, also put out a solo album in that space. They were overjoyed, I've read, to reconvene, as so many bands were, after the pandemic and get back to what they do best, which is making an awesome noise. We had them on the show way back in June of 2012, episode 340, playing live in the studio. It stands as one of our highlights at WBEZ because all the workers were running in and saying, "What the hell is that racket?" I think them and Mission of Burma stand as the two loudest bands we ever had. Let's dive into the album, play a track, and we'll give our opinions as always. This is a song called Let You Go by Screaming Females. The album is called Desire Pathway.
That is called Let You Go from the new Screaming Females record Desire Pathway. This band has been around for so long, Jim, and it's amazing. The same three people in this band started out in those basements in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and they're not that same band in terms of like the scrappiness of the sound, but the essence of the band is still there. They've gotten slightly more skilled at producing records or working with a producer to make records that sound a little better, quote unquote.
Yeah, well,
but they haven't lost the essence of what they are.
People are going to be knocked over. The first sound you hear on this album is a synthesizer. What?
Yeah. And And I love that sort of eerie opening, and then into that hammering guitar riff and that atmospheric bridge. You know, the craftsmanship is really picking up in the way they're writing songs, but there's still that dynamic there. They're not that punk band of old, and some people may be yearning for that. But I went back and listened to records that they made 10, 12 years ago, and I go, there's not a ton of difference between this record and that one. So you're saying, how have they grown? A lot of focus is on Marissa Paternoster as a guitar player, and she's terrific.
What a shredder.
She, you know, as they say, she shreds, right? But there's more nuance in her guitar playing here, you know? There's a lot more texture, a lot more subtlety. The other thing that I think is incredibly underrated about her is, what a singer.
Oh, yeah.
She's a terrific singer. When that vibrato wants to hit you between the eyes, it's like getting a punch in the face, you know? But at the same time, there's an awful lot of introspection here as well. This is apparently was written in the wake of a breakup. You don't get I don't get the full story. She's not spelling it out for you, but you can sort of more or less tell. There's been a change in her life, and she's singing about it. So there's an expressiveness in her voice and in her guitar playing that has emerged over the years that just indicates that she continues to grow in this. I don't know how they do it, you know, and that rhythm section is not to be trifled with either.
No,
it's a great rhythm section.
Great.
They're incredibly complimentary to what she's doing. They tour like crazy. They keep releasing good records. They're a model for other bands, you know. Like
Absolutely.
People are saying, what can a guitar-based band do today to be successful? Well, you could follow the model of the Screaming Females, you know.
I'll tell you what an inventive guitarist Marissa is. I have this, like, no wah-wah rule ever. You know, I think only, like, 70s porno soundtracks and the Stooges. And that's, like, no wah-wah should be allowed in rock and roll after that. Marissa can use any pedal she chooses, including the wah-wah. It sounds so great on Let You Go and some of the other tracks. She's continually reinventing. It's no coincidence that they recorded this album with producer Matt Bayless down at Pachyderm Studios in Minnesota. It's where Nirvana made In Utero. And the sense of dynamic contrast is straight out in Nirvana. And the, you know, Kurt Cobain, everybody talks about the voice. And we love Marissa's voice as well. But, you know, what a great guitarist, continually reinventing that instrument. That's what Marissa Paternoster does. This is a trio that could make a dozen more albums like this. And they're each going to sound a little different with a few surprises, but still sound pure scream ales, and boy, did I need this after Iris DeMent. Well, that's what we think of the new albums from Screaming Females and Iris DeMent, and now we want to hear from you. Share your opinions via voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Coming up next, we're talking with Rose and Rick from the Poster Children on Sound Opinions.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
And we're back. Poster Children formed in 1987 at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Rick Valentin and Rose Marshack have been the only constant members over nearly 35 years. They've had seven drummers, count them, seven.
Wow.
Including John Herndon, Johnny Machine, of Tortoise in the early 90s. You know, I remember seeing the band almost from the beginning. That debut album, Flower Plower, mm-hmm. which just got reissued, by the way.
Was not available for a long time.
No, terrific record, though. Put them on the map for a lot of people in the Midwest, and then they ended up getting signed to a major label, etc. But the one thing that was constant, didn't matter what label they were on, they were a completely independent entity all along. They did mm-hmm. everything, almost everything, managing themselves, booking shows,
driving.
They're a model for how bands can operate for decades on. And on top of that, the shows, I never felt. I went to probably 20-25 Poster Children
yeah,
shows
me too.
Over the years, and. You know, you never once felt like they were just up there for, you know, a paycheck or phoning it in or we're really tired tonight, guys, sorry. It always felt like it was like, you know, there was blood on the floor after it was over. You
well,
know, these guys were going all out all the time.
No doubt about it. And a lot of that, Greg, was always Rose Marshack. I mean, you know, she put herself 110% into every performance. It was impossible to see Rose on stage and not feel the excitement that she felt in that music. It was infectious.
Oh, yeah. The whole band was great. But Rose was kind of the show stealer, the scene stealer.
Yeah.
You know,
you watched her in an obtrusive way.
Yeah.
It was just her expressing her joy at making an awesome noise. And now she has written, in that same sort of energetic style, a memoir about her time in the band, Play Like a Man. We were honored to be the first interview Rose and Rick did after writing the book, but right off the bat, Rose realized she wasn't totally prepared to talk about this tome she had just finished.
I was worried you guys were going to ask me this question. I was like trying to think, what questions are they going to ask me? And the first thing that came to my mind is, why did you write this book? And I was like, oh no, what if they ask me that? And there it is. And I don't have a good answer for it. I mean, you know, Rick and I are now university professors, right? And those people are supposed to write books, so that's one answer, right? You know, we need to write books in order to look like university professors.
Justify your existence. Yeah, yeah, but it looks good. It impresses the other
professors. Right, exactly. It's weird. It's weird what impresses other people too. I mean, I start like understanding now, like us having toured in Europe and stuff. That's like a big thing. Other people haven't done that.
But to be fair, I mean, you were writing the tour reports, and then you were a columnist for a while for a local paper.
I know, that just
and
freaks
so
me out.
You've been a writer, and you've had some great mentors in terms of writing, you know, just out of luck.
Yeah.
Richard Powers was at the University of Illinois for a good period of time, and I think...
He and I had a programming episode. We like sat together and like programmed a data visualization, and so that was but I always really admired his work because he's scientist, a computer scientist, and an author and a musician. So
make the professors impressed, and you had much of the book in the form of those tour reports from when it was happening, but then there were other things you wanted to say, Rose. From the title on down, Play Like a Man, you have academic things that you want to say about gender, you had personal things you wanted to say about gender, and it starts with, I never thought about it. I did martial arts. There were not a lot of women. I did computer science early on before it was, you know, something to study in the academy. There were not a lot of women. I never thought about these things. And yet now it seemed like you wanted to think about them and put them in a context.
That was the first thing I was terrified of doing also. Like, because I didn't think about any of that stuff. And I can read, you know, scholarly books on gender studies and everything. And that's not my background is I'm just a computer scientist. You know, I don't know any of that stuff. So I started studying all that. And I remember just like, oh my God, what am I going to say? What if I just say, you know, I don't know anything about this. So, you know, I'll just skip it. What if I do that? And I remember like while I was writing this, the Me Too movement happened. Like that's been in the past 5 years, right? There's like the famous David Foster Wallace little speech that he gives about the fish being asked what the water's like, and the fish saying, "What are you talking about? What water? You know, fish doesn't know because it's the water's all around him."
You're right.
Yeah.
Because the title is just, you know, I got to read this book now just for the title alone. And when you explain it in the book, and I'm going to let you explain it, but I was of two minds on that subject. I go, that's kind of cool, but it's also kind of, is that an insult, you know? So tell us about the title of the book and where that
comes
from.
Do you mean it's an insult to all men? That's not what you mean, right?
Yeah, I mean, it could be taken any number of ways. Oh,
well. Or self-deprecating. Why not just play like Rose?
Yeah.
You know, and it should be said at this point, Greg, our critical observation stepping in, there are a few performers in rock. You know, Rose is on a select list of someone who invests heart and soul. It is 1,000% present on stage, right? In Escape. Not that you don't, Rick.
I'm not saying that.
But the joy that Rose evinces performing with Poster Children to this day is inspiring.
Rose has always been the scary one in Poster Children.
Yeah, but in a good way.
So, in a good way. I mean, yeah.
So you've answered your own question that Play Like a Man is a compliment. Yeah. You've answered it.
but who said that to you, and what was the context?
Yeah, this is another, like, you know, there's no plan for anything. I just remembered my dad saying this to me, and I was writing about it. And then it was like, oh, that's probably a good title for the book. So when I was little, I was playing the, you know, I was practicing the piano, and my dad was very, very harsh on me. You know, just kind of a perfectionist. And then I would talk back to him all the time, too. I didn't make a mistake. And you know, we'd get into arguments, physical arguments.
I meant to do that.
Yeah. I was terrible. Oh, my goodness. I was just like a terrible kid. But one time I remember him telling me, and he's a jazz musician, right? And he still practices the trumpet every other day and writes down how much time he spent practicing the trumpet. But I remember him telling me, you know, you need to play more like a man. I think he said that. Like, you need to, and this is like 1970s, right? And I'm playing like one of those songs that you would want to play very hard. Like, you'd want to punch the piano, kind of, right? And I remember him saying, I can tell when it's a woman or a man playing the piano. When you know, without seeing, I can tell the gender of the person playing the piano. And I wrote in the book, right? You know, and see, this is why I could write like theses about how horrible this is and what a victim I was from this. But I, you know, it was the 1970s, and I was just like, oh, well, then I better play harder, because it's known at that point that women play weaker. You know, I mean, it doesn't mean that women. This is where I hope I get lots of hate mail about this. Again, this is the 1970s. And you want to clarify? This is why Rick is here, to clarify for me, so I don't get
to
shot.
It was never true. You listen to Carole King let loose sometimes.
Yeah,
you know.
It's just, to me, it meant play harder. Just use your muscles more. I mean, that's what it meant. I wasn't like, well, you know, I didn't feel like, I wrote this in the book. I didn't feel like, you know, women are inferior to men. So, you know, I didn't feel like that at all. I just felt like he's telling me to play harder.
Well, yeah, I think part of it is that you don't understand how much of a unicorn you were in computer science in college, and then also
in
music.
Yeah.
And then seeing how that ties back to with what happened with your father, where he's very supportive of your music, but you didn't take that moment as... You didn't even understand that it could be a reflection on you as a woman.
No, not at all. No, I was just like, oh, okay, I'll play harder then. Yeah, no, like that. That's, yeah, in the book, I think all this stuff kind of came back to me, and I started hating men from writing this book. No, it's like
Rick accepted, your husband.
I mean, I said, yeah, wait a minute. I was sexisted at, you know. I mean, but my whole life, I never felt like that. But, you know, like little memories came back. Like, yeah, going to CS 391 with Professor Moroga. God bless him. I remember like being stuck in that class, but I remember going to his office hours. And I wrote this in the book, too. And him saying, this class isn't good for women. And I was like, oh, at least I was, you know, smart enough to go, oh, I better get out of this class then. He's probably right. But the next like computer science class I went into, I like looked around. I was like, maybe there aren't a lot of women in here. And like, you know, I just like a fish in the water. I'm like looking around. I'm like, one, two, wow, there's three of us. And it's like a class of like 100. And then I was like, oh, wow. You know.
So you were in this environment, but you never really would notice. Or no. You kind of, part of the theme here, I think, is that you were kind of
totally
like clueless.
Clueless.
But in a positive way.
It's and like I wanted to call the book Clueless, but there's already a book called Clueless. So.
No. I mean, it we've talked to so many musicians, Rose, who only realize, you know, it's an issue when they're walking in the club with their bass, you know, case, and some jerk says to them, oh, you're helping the band load
in.
He's like, no, I am the
band.
Yeah,
it happens, and that's just like, for me, I would just develop, like, a callus and know that I need to walk in between the guys. Like, if I'm last in the line, like, there's one of those little, like, thin rails that you got to walk through. I would always position, I remember always making sure that I was in between you and Jim or something like that, so they wouldn't stop me. Because if I walked behind you guys, they would stop me. I tested it. Damn you, men.
That's amazing. And there is the anecdote in the book, correct me if I'm wrong, something to the effect that you had to identify yourself as like the manager. Because if you didn't, they would start asking you questions about the instrument you played, and you were just like done with that whole conversation.
I remember it's like an East Coast venue, I remember just saying, I'm the manager, I'm the band's manager. Otherwise, they would be like, well, otherwise they would question if you're with the band or you're just, you know, just hanging out. And probably the band doesn't want people around when they're sound checking, so they're getting ready to throw me out. So I'd be like, I'm the manager. Manager.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's unbelievable.
Coming up next, we reflect on how the music industry has changed since Poster Children got signed to a major label. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
And we are back. We're talking with Rose Marshak and Rick Valentin of the Poster Children. Let's jump back into the conversation.
You start out at the University of Illinois in the mid-80s, and you're playing these gigs, and you were an independent band, sort of in the punk aesthetic, DIY, do-it-yourself. And you maintain that, and you continue to maintain that to this day. You know, people will be struck, I think, reading the book, realizing, hey, these guys were on a major label, and they still didn't get a tour bus. They still didn't stay in hotel rooms. They've slept on people's floors. And I remember the first time I talked to you guys, you know, way back, I think it was like we were talking at South by Southwest or something like that in Austin. I think it was like 1990 or something. And the same things that you were saying to me then apply to you now. Like you never changed, you know, in terms of your approach to being like, we're getting this money as a loan from the label. We understand that we're going to have to pay it back at some time. So we're just not going to take it. And I think almost every other band I've ever talked to took the money, you know, which I think is kind of unique. So Rose, I mean, you get into some of that in the book, but that idea was there from the very beginning and you maintained it. How were you able to, you know, stay true to that ideal? Through thick
and
thin.
This is totally off topic, but this reminds me of why I don't do cocaine. Okay, because that's like totally unsustainable. So you guys know you stand in front of students now. You got to talk to them. You can't be like, don't do drugs, because some drugs are legal now. But you can be like, don't do the bad drugs. Like, you know, don't do this. You know, I still love you if you do those drugs, but this one I wouldn't do. And I was like, you know, just. I was just going off and I was like, you shouldn't do cocaine because it's totally unsustainable. You're going to have to keep paying for it. It makes you feel fantastic for like a little while. This is why I'm getting to the tour bus. It makes you feel fantastic for a little while and then you have to pay again, you know, like you have to, and it's not so good for you. So if we took money for a tour bus, we would become reliant on a tour bus. And there's an arc. You know, I think I talked about like quoted Gravity's Rainbow or something in my book, because there's an arc if you sign to a major label. There's an arc where you begin, and then there's an arc where you're not on the major label anymore, and there you're not going to have like this teat to suck from. So that's why like I don't do cocaine and I don't take tour buses.
Well, you know, another theme that runs through the book is this idea of independence, as Greg said. And, you know, Rose, Greg and I never understood it at the time. We're writing for major daily newspapers, and we are writing about super obscure indie bands, and we're writing about, you know, Veruca Salt gets signed to a major, or Urge Overkill, you know, and then we got to cover Bob Dylan, too, you know. That notion of sellout, you know, you anybody who signs to major labels instantly a sellout. They're no longer credible. The 10 years it took to get there, the fact that this album is as good or better than the last that was independent, the fact that independent labels are expert, sometimes more so than screwing than major labels screwing over the artists, right? What an antiquated concept. I mean, Greg and I laughed at it at the moment. The new Urge Overkill is good or it's not good. Doesn't matter. And yet you've managed to always, you and Rick managed to maintain the respect of the leading avatars of morality, of independence. You know, you've got blurbs on the back of the book from Ian MacKaye and Steve Albini, you know.
Yeah, I can't believe that. I can't believe they, and on top of it, one of them, I think it was Steve, was like, I'm going to feel really weird writing a nice blurb about you because you've written all this nice stuff in the book about me, you know. And I was like, oh, I guess, yeah, that is kind of weird, but, you know, but thank you anyway for writing a blurb.
Well, I do remember when the sellout discussion was really, really rampant, obviously, you know, in that sort of smells like teen spirit feeding frenzy. And the one thing I always went back to is like, well, there are a lot of records that were really important to me, you know, like Entertainment by Gang of Four, right?
Major label.
Iggy and the Stooges.
Yeah, Ramones. Major label. Same one you
exactly.
were on.
Talking Heads, right? And so processing that and then kind of decoding it and realizing, okay, it's not simply about the label and the money. It's about the integrity of the artist, right? And then you can... That's what we kind of did is when we were decoding that major label process, it was kind of like, well, okay, what label and what labels actually still support artists and weird artists? And that's how we made our choice. Now that option went away very quickly, you know, as the economics of the business changed. No major labels could kind of have their cool weird bands to keep everybody happy, you know, and they just had to hack that from the economics of the major label system. But at the time, there was a pathway, I think, of maintaining, your artistic integrity. And we didn't call it that. It was just like, we kind of want to do what we want to do. And we've seen other bands get ruined by all sorts of things. And that was the thing about Champagne, is it did not just have an active scene while we were there. There's the, early Irving Azoff REO Speedwagon scene, right? In those early days.
Yeah, he was booking bands and plotting world domination even when we were in
college.
And then
there was the scene right before us, which had...
The Last Gentleman, right?
Well, no, before The Last Gentleman, which... Well, the Elvis Brothers had sort of come out of that, but that band Screams, not the punk band. There was the band, and they had gone through this nightmare process. So there were people who had already gone through that we knew and we were around, who had done the kind of, I wouldn't say it's selling out, but had been burned by
missteps. And then, and also Steve Albini, like, I don't know if you feel like he taught you everything you know, but I feel like he taught me everything I know.
Well, that essay, what is it? Everything you need to know about, whatever about the famous essay he wrote. I mean,
all of your friends and bands were already this screwed.
I mean, that was just kind of similar to the conversation you would have with him
when you were recording, right?
After recording and barbecuing, and it was like, okay, you got to watch out for this stuff, and this is what happens, and this is how distributors work. So he just had a general working knowledge of the music industry, and so we had that.
We listened.
Yeah, and this was before all the behind the music stuff, but if you were like a music nerd, like we were, music nerds, you kind of already started seeing these patterns, and even patterns that maybe weren't accurate, but like I always remember, it's like Husker Du signed to Warner Brothers and it seems like that destroyed them. Obviously now you know the history. There was a lot more going on, but it's like that more limited perspective, you'd go, oh, okay, so what went wrong there? Or then I remember reading an interview, with REM, and they said, well, no, we split our songwriting equally, because that's why bands break up. It's because if they always fight over songwriting royalties. It's like, oh, okay. And so if you just paid attention and looked beyond the mythology of the music industry, you could see, oh, okay, these are all the areas, the pitfalls. And it's like, if you want to be happy at the end of the day and you want to still be a musician, that was the other thing, is talking to people who had gone through the ringer and they were like, I don't play music anymore. It ruined me. And it was like, okay, I absolutely know this is the one thing that's sort of saved my life. Indie rock saved my life. And it's like, okay, I got to make sure that I don't ruin the one thing, that kind of rescued me.
Well, and the one advantage, right, of us being old now, and three of the four of us chatting, being professors, is, to our students, right, this concept of the major label anointing you and giving you money and making you a star, I mean, it's gone. It's all gone. Maybe it still exists for, Lady Gaga or whatever, okay? But for all intents and purposes, that system, it took entirely too long between Robert Johnson and the internet, but good riddance to it, right?
I had the funniest thing. I had Ian MacKay talk in a music business class yesterday, and people were asking questions, and then a girl asked a question. She said, what advice do you have for those of us who are between 17 and 24 who want to be in the music industry? And he told her his advice. It was amazing.
What was
it?
Don't be in the music industry.
He just explained what the music industry was, that it was a machine that had nothing to do with music. It was all just a machine with money. And he had all kinds. He's wonderful to have in a class.
Don't be in the industry. Make music if you want to make music.
Totally. I'm going to have to explain his answer to her, I think, later on, maybe.
But that 30-year reflection, right? What's amazing to me is everything that was happening in that indie rock scene that influenced us and kind of we became a part of is really the map for how to be a musician or an artist now, which is that you build an audience. You make connections, instead of a fanzine, now it's a blog or, social media. And all of those things that were happening in this little underground scene became the model because of the internet, right? It all just turned into the model for how to be a musician and an artist in the 21st century. And so, yeah, all those talk, all the talk, you know, when somebody still believes in the mythology, oh, I'm going to get signed to a label and get money. And it's like, you have to explain, well, no, what happens now is if you have 50,000 or 100,000 followers, or you've gotten, you've made a viral TikTok video, right? Then the major label will call, come calling. Like, you, once you've built an audience, once you've gone through this independent self-promotion DIY process to build an audience and prove that you have something that's worth investing in, then the money comes in.
And the other thing, too, is that a lot of bands don't want to even think about a lot of the things that Poster Children were thinking about from day one, you know, running that side of, they wanted to create, they wanted to make records, they wanted to tour. I don't want to worry about the money. I don't want to think about the business side of this operation at all. But it seemed like, and that, and you can't blame them, because that's a lot of work, right?
That was,
it's probably even more work than the creative side.
Exactly.
In some ways.
That was an epiphany I had at some point, where I was like telling other musicians, like, oh, you gotta make sure you're in control of your cover art. You gotta make your videos. You gotta do all this and everything like that. And then at some point I realized, no, that's just our way of doing things, and maybe my control freak nature, but it's like, some people just want to do the music.
Yeah.
Right? They don't want to do everything. And the business is also part of that. But I don't know if it's apocryphal, but the James Brown quote is like, everyone, you know, when they're talking about the music, all they think about, you know, all they talk about is the music, and they never think about the business. Right. And so there is, I think, a responsibility to understand the business. But I just think at that time, great record executive, I can say this, Howie Klein loved us, yeah, Rose, and was really supportive of the band, you know, being in his office and kind of peppering him with business questions. And at some point he kind of shut down, which is like, because in that environment,
too much.
And he, an amazing guy, if you look at his history in the music industry, but it was just like, oh, yeah, I don't want to talk to the artist about why they're not on the radio, right? Or why the record isn't selling in Montana, right? You know, it's like, I want to talk to them about the creative side, and then I want to talk to the manager about it. And so, yeah, there's a reason for that also, because as a creative person, sometimes you don't want to know why no one has bought your record, or why you don't want to think about it, or you don't want to think about, oh, you mean we have to pay these people in order to get on the radio? You know, and so that was... There's always the mythology, and outside the music industry, you know, it's very hard to talk to people about the way the industry actually is, because that mythology of how, you know, oh, you were on a major label, that must have been great. And it's like, no, it was a complicated relationship, and it was not all, you know, money and drugs. You know, it was a very complex business arrangement.
I remember... Oh, yeah. Like teaching music business, right? And then somewhere like around week six out of the 16 weeks of the first semester, you know, you kind of get into like, you know, oh, yeah, no, the records that you see in the record store, they're placed there by the record labels. They're not, it's not somebody's choice. Like, what even that, you know, what, it, like, they, the students start getting really depressed. They're like, this is terrible. Yeah. They like learn more and more about that. And then you got to go, it's not terrible. It's reality, and it's wonderful. Wonderful, you know, not everything, I would say to them, not everything has to be wonderful and happy, but there are all kinds of different opportunities in the music industry, especially now, you know, not the music industry, but in music, there's all types of different things that you can do. You don't have to be sad about how, you know, the old music industry worked.
The eyes wide open, you know, that's what you want,
power.
Knowledge, but, you know, and Rose, talking about the creative side, I was struck by you would casually drop in these references to the, and then, you know, we walked off stage and I cried my eyes out, you know, and I'm just like, well, you know, I like the whole idea that this is kind of like life and death for you, these shows. It wasn't like, did you guys, I mean, and that's hard to do. Like, you guys toured a lot, but it seemed like you poured every, you know, you were able to sort of focus on what you were doing on that stage, and perhaps you were overly hard on yourself, but I'm curious about that attitude that you bring to the stage. Was there some other outside forces that were coming into the way that you felt that day, or how you played and how you felt about it afterward, to the point where you would break down in tears? Or I'm just curious about your mindset when you're up there playing.
I don't know the answer to that. Are you going to answer? Can you answer that, Rick? I don't think you should, but
I mean, honestly, you know, we saw the Minutemen in person, Husker Du numerous times. Naked Reagan. I mean, the Fugazi later on, right? Seeing Fugazi and seeing, oh, even the fact that we shared a town with the Digits, and seeing a band
God.
Like the Digits,
yeah,
what a great band,
yeah, raised the bar in terms of live performance. And so there was kind of like the replacements side of things, where it would be like, oh, it could be this shambles of a show, or you could have an amazing show. And then there was kind of like the military precision, overwhelmingly sort of powerful show, and I think we gravitated towards that standard of live performance.
I would cry because Rick would dock us every time we made a mistake. He would dock us $25, and he just had this little signal that, no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah,
that's a James Brown thing.
I know. That's a great answer. Yeah, you
I
just
love
sort of
that
like have so much
of the James Brown drummers, the two of them, and the one is just standing, waiting, like wrapped. Like waiting to be switched over. Oh, that's
oh,
one of my favorite
photographs. Whiplash is real.
Oh yeah, totally. But yeah, no. That I think it was there was a standard, performance standard. But it was also that idea that that understanding that if you're playing in front of three people, for instance, in a town that you've never been to before, those are the three most important people in the scene, because they showed up to a show for a band that they hadn't heard of, from out of town band on a Tuesday night. And it's like, you have to play your best show possible, because the next time you come to that town, those three people are either going to tell everyone, well, I saw that band and they just totally blew it because no one was there. Or they say, this was the most amazing live band I've seen. Everybody they know, they tell, come see this band the next time you're in town. And so it was part of that scene and environment we were in, which was just like, you have to bring it every night.
And you'd stand under, I remember standing under Mike Watt and like hoping his sweat would drip on me, or like standing in front of standing in front of Ian, you know, watching Fugazi, and just like you can't like the feeling it brings to the audience is like another David Foster Wallace thing, right, from Infinite Jest. Is I sound like a book snob, but like I've only read two books, right? But where the tennis kid, I think I even quoted this in the book, like the tennis kid wants to be like a famous tennis star or something. And then he talks to a guru, and the guru tells him that, you know, the way that this star makes you feel is not the way the star feels inside. Like, he doesn't feel the joy that you feel when you watch him. So standing up on the stage there and I got to make people feel the way that, you know, Ian makes me feel when I see him, or Mike Watt or whoever. Yeah, this is I'm kind of just answering what Rick said.
Rose, you are, I got to say, Greg, Rose is the most self-effacing author we have ever interviewed. I don't believe it. You know, and Rick is here. I mean, I know you guys are an excellent team, right? But it's like, you don't want to talk about your own book. You make those points in the book, Rose, and you do it so well and so entertainingly and with such passion. That the joy of the Tuesday night, the first time in town, three people, and the next time, 12 people.
Yeah, that was
and
the
so
best.
It goes, 36. You write about that, and that's why we do this, right?
Yeah, yeah. I just hope that people get the joy out. This is my talking point for the book, is that there are lots of books and TV shows about bands that, you know, nobody knew who they were. They got signed to a major label, and then terrible things happened to them. And this is a book about band that nobody knows who they were. They got signed to a major label, and still nobody knows who they were, but wonderful things happened to them.
Yeah, a life.
Rose, thank you for a wonderful book. Rick, thanks for
helping Rose talk about the book.
Yes.
Since she didn't want
to. I tell
her
she has to do these interviews by herself, and she's...
No, you know, you understand me way better than I understand myself. Thank God you're here. There's a reason why the first word in the book is Rick, and the second word is Valentin. There's a reason.
Well, you know, everybody, the other thing I was going to say about the book is everybody always talks about Ira and Georgia, Georgia and Ira, Ira and Georgia, you know, as if like that's the only couple in rock that's ever been inspiring. But I think you guys are as a team as well.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for yeah, it's amazing to be on this show.
Thanks.
That wraps up our conversation with Rose Marshak and Rick Valentin of the Poster Children. Now we want to hear from you. I know a lot of our listeners have got memories of Poster Children shows. Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, with your thoughts. Greg, what is on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we want to pay tribute to Trugoy the Dove, the great De La Soul MC who died recently, as well as take a deep dive into 3 Feet High and Rising, their amazing debut album, on occasion that record, as well as the entire De La Soul catalog, is now available on streaming services for the first time. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Good stuff. You can't not love De La Soul. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Lauren Holt, and our social media consultant is Katie Cobb.